This morning's reading is from Ephesians chapter 6, verses 1 to 9. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Honour your father and mother, which is the first commandment with a promise, that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. Fathers, do not exasperate your children. Instead, bring them up in the training and instruction of the Lord. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with respect and fear, and with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them not only to win their favour when their eye is on you, but, like slaves of Christ, doing the will of God from your heart. Serve wholeheartedly, as if you were serving the Lord, not men, because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he is slave or free. And masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours is in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him.
Good morning. The passage this morning is one of those passages which I really wish had fallen to somebody else to deal with. It's a passage which is so loaded with personal application that to come and tell you how to live this one out is rather an onerous responsibility. I feel a little bit like perhaps somebody who has just been in a storm and in the heart of that storm somehow surviving, and then as you swim ashore after terrible circumstances, you arrive at the shore and there you find somebody with a digital camera and says, well, look, we're making a program on swimming. Would you like to give us some swimming lessons? Because life is a storm. And if, as parents, you've not discovered that you're going to be in the center of storms at times, and how you hold it together, how you cope, how you relate to other people, people who you deeply love, people who are hurting you, people who you think should be behaving differently, then you realize that you've been behaving badly yourself. And the whole thing becomes a mix. And Paul is speaking into that very situation. And he knows what's going on. He's not a fool. He's not some ivory tower academic who hasn't got a clue as to what goes on. He's not like the professor who is a marvelous professor of moral theology and wrote marvelous works telling parents how they should treat their children. And then one day he was laying a path in his garden and he'd mixed the concrete and it was nicely laying when the child from next door ran across his garden and ran through the concrete. And his expletives weren't worthy of repetition. And the neighbor shouted out, I thought you taught people how to teach to treat their children. And he said, sir, I can deal with children in the abstract, but not in the concrete. Coming to our relationships, this will touch us all, touches me. I'm embarrassed to be the one who has to bring what's going on here. But it's crucially important. It's as much a part of the gospel as the death of Christ itself is. Can I emphasize that? This is as much a part of the gospel as the death of Christ is. It's the outworking of that. It's this which makes the impact in other people as they see us as Christians coping with the same issues that they have to cope with. As Christians, we can be very keen to be card-carrying Christians. I fear that there is a similarity in our mentality between the political parties who all are anxious to be green because it's the right thing to be, but you know will not implement the implications of it because it's too difficult and it will create too many problems. So we give word assent. We say, yes, these are important. But when it comes to actually putting into practice, we're not really that good. And if we were that good, I'm sure that society would be very different. We'd be very different. Our impact of the gospel would be very different. And it's because we tend to sort of give a consent to things which are Christian. We say that we're following Christ. But do you understand what that means? To be a disciple of Christ means that he determines the very nature of our human existence, our expectations and our desires. That we put them at his disposal. We tell him that we genuinely want his will to be done in our lives. And that's the priority. And everything else gets judged in the context of that. Now that is painful. It can cut across so many things that perhaps we didn't even realize it will affect us in. It will affect us in our marriages. It will affect us in our children, the relationship with our children. It will affect us in our employment or in the way that we handle those who we employ. It goes right across our lives. And the non-Christian watches on and says, well, is this Christian thing just about the head, or is it about the heart and about the life? I think it was Gandhi who said that the trouble with the Christian message was not the message itself, but it hadn't been lived. Show me somebody who lives by the Bible, and I will believe him. That was sort of the gist of what he said. And the world looks on. And the world sees a community that professes to follow Christ, no different from itself by and large. And we don't make the impact because of that. We're more anxious to be part of the society that we live in than we are to be distinctively Christ's. So we're looking at this passage now, Ephesians 6, 1-9. And if you to look in some Bibles where it gives headings. The headings, of course, were not part of the original text. They've been put there by translators to try to help us through. But the headings, and if you read commentaries, they normally give headings. And very often this is headed the household code. The household code. In fact, the household code is found in other documents outside of the Christian Bible. Not identical to this, but general guidelines as to how people are supposed to behave in the family and in society. So these household codes were quite common. In fact, some scholars tried to argue that this had just been taken over from other household codes that are found in the ancient world. But in fact, there are things which are so distinctive within this teaching that its uniqueness cannot be questioned. But Paul speaks under the titles of what is right, what is promised, what is needed, what is required, and what is visual. And first of all, what is right in chapter 6, verse 1. Paul says, children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Children, obey your parents in the Lord, for this is right. Now, the word children is tekna. It's a Greek word which isn't talking about age. It's talking about relationship. So it actually is telling even those of us who are grown up about how our responsibilities to our parents. So it's not just the children and how they're to relate to you. It's about you and how you relate to their grandparents as well. It goes all the way through. And what you want your children to be in the way they relate to you will turn out in the way that they see you relating to your parents and how you put that into practice. Let's be clear about that. There can be no dichotomy. You are their model. They will take the values by what they see. Now, I don't know about you, but I wasn't brought up in a Christian home. I'm very grateful for many of the things my parents did for me. But there was no Christian role model. I'm sad about that. It left a huge gap in my life. And those of you who have similar, I'd urge you to find mentors, people that you trust, who you feel will help you in this. If you marry and you have children, seek mentors, people that you can confide in. You need that support. You need that ongoing help. If it's not there within your natural upbringing that you've been mentored by Christian parents who you know were striving to please Christ, you need help. It's not just good enough to know Bible verses. You need help. When you fail, when you're distressed about yourself, when you see things happening and you don't know how to react to them, you need help. Churches need to gear themselves to give that help. We do as a church need to be facing that. It's not just a matter of having home groups. It's a matter of giving the care and support that is never inevitably within any community of people that comes together and associates closely as we do as a church. And right here in this letter, as he concludes, he's applying this incredible teaching that he's been giving. It is incredible, the letter to the Ephesians. And he comes to the conclusion and he applies it to the families in the church at Ephesus. It applies to you, to your family, to me, to my family. My parents are dead. Barbara's mother still lives. We have to try to work that out. You can't impose what you want to do for them upon them. Of course not. They're right. They've got rights. They're individuals. But you still need to be considering them and caring for them. So Paul says, children, obey your parents in the Lord. Now the term in the Lord is a way in which it can be said as for the Lord or as unto the Lord. It's not actually obey your Christian parents. But obey your parents in the way that Christ wants you to obey them. So this isn't exempt from those of us who don't have Christian parents. This is something which, if our parents are asking reasonable things of us, we are to respond to. Now, I do say reasonable things, because if they're non-Christians, or even as they're Christians, they ask us to do something which is against our conscience, against what we know is God's will for us, then we have to draw a line. It's the same principle. Render unto Caesar the things unto Caesar, and unto God the things that are God's. It's not that parents are to dictate, but they still are to have honor. Now that puts something upon us older Christians who are parents. We can't demand honor. Let's be very clear about it. You can't tell your child, the Bible tells you that you've got to do this, and that's what you've got to do, and you've got to obey me, and you've got to do this. You have to earn honor. You have to earn it. You have to demonstrate to the children who God has given you that your concern is for them. It's your desire for their well-being. That when you do ask them to do something which seems to be unreasonable, it's out of love for them and care for them, and you want to protect them from the dangers which you see. And if you were honest enough, you'd have to say, have hurt me, and I've made the mistakes that I don't want you to make. Sometimes, we have to say, sometimes you're going to make them, because I can't force it upon you. But Paul says, children, obey your parents as unto the Lord. You're doing this because you're a believer, because Christ has claims upon you, for this is right. Nature tells us it's right. Go anywhere in the world and the principles of society are that children should be under the authority of their parents. Scripture tells us it's right. It enforces us, it gives us principles by which that relationship is to be lived out. it is right. We had the privilege of some years ago having, just for really a very brief period, a visitor from Korea stay with us. He was passing through, he was on his way to somewhere, and I'd met him in Korea and said, when you're in the UK, please come and stay with us. And as we were reasonably near Heathrow, of course, he took up the offer and said, I'm passing through, any chance? So we were delighted to have him. He's a senior leader in the Korean church. I won't mention names, otherwise the Koreans here will be trying to associate him. But it was a delight to have him. On the Saturday evening, we sat round and we listened to him. He had this lovely Asian method of teaching through stories. We'd ask him a question. Well, my father, and he would go on to tell us about his father, about what his father taught him. So he was handing it on to us. This is what I think. It's what I've been taught. This is what I think. It was delightful. Something that made a big impression upon us was how he related to his parents. He came to realize that his elderly parents had needs that he was responsible for. So he tried to study their needs. He tried to think about them. And he came to the conclusion with his wife that they were to pay them a monthly allowance. And that's what they did, to make sure that they were not in hardship. They had their own income, but he was anxious that they were not going to live in hardship. So they paid them a monthly allowance. Can I ask you if you've thought of your parents in that way? It's not a matter of doling out money and where it's not necessary, but to be saying, well, there are times that they want to do something and they just don't have that money. Okay, they can get by, but how about just a sum of money? It's not necessarily a huge sum, but just month by month going into their accounts so that when there's something that they want to do, to go on holiday with a friend or to pay a visit to a member of the family that they're anxious to go and see, but they don't have that income, it's there as a source for them to be able to use. I'd like to suggest to you that you think about that. It's all so easy to be concerned about people who live overseas with huge needs and to actually miss the fact that people who you are responsible for are not in a position where they can properly live the life that they would like to live or would be good for them to live. So Paul says, children, obey your parents. Obey them. The limit of that obedience, of course, is that they mustn't impose things upon you which are going to break God's command. Let's be very clear of this. It is not that you slavishly obey your parents. And if you've been in a wedding service which I've conducted, I normally make this point that when a couple marry, this is a new unit coming into existence. For this purpose shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave to his flesh, and they shall be one flesh. And the parents from now on have got no right to interfere in that relationship. If parents interfere in the relationship of their children, they have lost that respect and honor. When you marry, your responsibility is to your spouse and to your children. That's the first responsibility. Other responsibilities going out to the family are next to your parents. They're your responsibility. So let's not get the impression that this is telling you that you are to obey regardless. If parents interfere, they lose that respect. Obviously, you can continue to support them and care for them and show Christian concern for them by providing for them and giving them the consideration that they need. But if they're going to try to interfere in your marriage, if there is genuine concern and they're trying to give you advice, then perhaps you ought to be listening, particularly if other people are trying to say the same thing. Maybe, just maybe, there is a word of warning because they see dangers on the horizon. But any interference in which they're undermining the relationship, that is an absolute anathema for a Christian couple. So what is right, and now what is promised in verses 2 to 3? Honour your father and mother, which is the first commandment, with promise that it may go well with you and that you may enjoy long life on the earth. So this is God's commandment, our respect of our parents. It's not an option. We cannot claim to be following Christ if we don't put this commandment into action. Can I ask you, how often do you think of your parents? Do you think of their needs? Do you think in terms of the problems in their aging they're facing? Do you see them as an inconvenience? Or are you facing the reality that you have a responsibility? And God has given you, He's given me, He gives us all that responsibility. We're living in a society which shoves the elderly off into nursing homes and care homes and leaves them there. And an occasional visit clears the conscience. That cannot be a Christian response. I'm not saying that parents shouldn't be in elderly, in care homes. That may well be the place that they wish to be. It may be the best place for them in the certain circumstances. But it should not be our natural way of thinking. It should be a thing that we come to because other options are not there, not possible to fulfill. Rather than that it's just the dumping ground for the inconvenient in society. In this case, the West has much to answer for because its example is being followed around the world. And even in a country like China, which would have been so strong, and Korea and other countries where there is such strength in family values and family life, the pattern is being followed. Dumping grounds are being built. The young and the affluent, too busy with their lives. They move away, they have no contact with their parents, and the whole of the structure of family life and society is collapsing. God commands this. It's not an option. It's the first commandment with promise. Now, some have pointed out that it's not the first commandment with promise. There's other commandments earlier in Genesis, and then it's pointed out also that this is the only commandment in the Ten Commandments. Well, it would seem that the general gist of it is that it's the first commandment in the law, which begins in Exodus 20, where God gives the law to Moses. But then other laws are given. And here is the first commandment in that law, the Torah. And Paul says this is the first command with promise. Do you notice that God encourages? It's the first command with promise that it may go well with you. We must be very careful about failing to appreciate how it is needed to encourage and to support. Encouragement is in the very heart of God. He wants to encourage us. It can so easily be that all we're concerned about is encouragement for ourselves. One of the most lovely gifts is to know somebody who genuinely has a ministry of encouragement. And by that I don't mean a ministry of oppression, that you encourage to manipulate people so that you get them where you want them. Because that's how encouragement is often used in business and so on. It's not that. It's encouragement for the person's own sake. And regardless of what their interests are, and regardless of the direction they're going in general terms, if it's not wrong, you encourage them. You acknowledge their achievements. You support them. And God's doing that here. He gives encouragement. This is the first command with promise that it may go well with you. He says, do this. This will be the reward. This will be the outcome. It'll go well with you. Now, you may be striving to do this, and you might say, but it's not going well with me. I can assure you that I've had a rough time as I've tried to put this into action. Well, it may be that you have rough times, but it will still go well with you. The outcome will be far, far better than if you are driven by your own instincts and by your own interests. It'll be far, far better. It will go well with you. And also, it's not just it will go well with you, but that you will enjoy a long life on the earth. That was a promise there in the Old Testament. Do you realize that God does desire that you have a long life? I'm not preaching a wealth and health gospel. Sin is a tragedy. Injustices and everything else that make up this world are what we're caught up in. But it's still God's desire that you have a long life. God has no pleasure in sickness. He has no pleasure in tragedy. Our doctrine of sin and the doctrine of God's sovereignty must in no way make God an ogre who is indifferent, and all that he's concerned about is somehow making you obey him and making you into the sort of person that he wants you to be. It's much more than that. He desires your good. He wants your blessing. I'm not going to say it will work out easy, and I'm not going to say, of course not, that some here will not die prematurely. We had a student at college, and he was a delightful fellow, married to a delightful girl, very keen youth worker in the church which he'd been in. He and his wife felt called to Brazil, and they were going out to Brazil. He'd graduated, and he was expecting to go out to Brazil in just months to be a missionary. And then we heard news, it was stunning, on Sunday morning, that the previous day, he'd been out with a group of young fellows. He was a keen rock climber. And helping them climb a rock, he leant over to try and encourage somebody coming up who'd frozen on the rock face. And he relied upon his rope, which was attached to a rock. And something terrible happened, and the rope gave way. And he tumbled over to his death, leaving a delightful young bride and a child. Experience tells me we can't claim promises that we will live long lives. But even if we have short lives, it's important for us to live those lives as God would want us to live them. But God does desire that we have long lives. Shouldn't be ashamed of that. But also, as Christians, we should know that when our lives come to an end, whether it's after a long time or after a short time, God, in his mercy, has forgiven us and accepted us, and there's no fear of entering into his presence, and we're accepted by him. This is a temporary place. But here we have the responsibility of obeying Christ and following him and serving him. What is promised? What is needed? Chapter 6, verse 4, Fathers, do not exacerbate your children. Instead, bring them up in training and the instruction of the Lord. Fathers, do not exacerbate your children. Don't put unnecessary pressures on them. Don't discourage them. Nurture them. Someone once wrote that some people are more concerned with the well-being of their plants and animals than they are with their children. They give more time to planning how their garden will be looked after and who will look after their pets than they even do. Their children are put into a system and it goes on and on. The school does this and the club does this. And it's all delegated and they allow it all to happen. That's not to be like that. Parents, your chief responsibility is to each other and to your children. And after you fulfill that responsibility, then to others. there is the danger of being so caught up in Christian work, and this isn't grounds for excusing involvement, but it can be easy to be caught up in Christian work that you neglect what you're supposed to be first called to. And that's not to happen. Children must sense that before everyone else, they're loved and valued by their parents. When there's a real problem going on, don't hesitate to say, I need to take a break out of these commitments. I need to be available for my child. There are issues that I've got to be there for him, for her for. That's your responsibility. It's your God-given responsibility. It's your biblical responsibility. It's easy to get that out of perspective. A woman went to see Spurgeon once. Told Spurgeon. Spurgeon was a great preacher in the Victorian era. Huge, huge congregation. The type of congregation that we have here about in Korea and in America. Made a huge impact, Spurgeon. This woman went and said, oh, Mr. Spurgeon, I feel God wants me to be a missionary. And Spurgeon said, well, tell me a little bit about yourself. And she explained that she had 6 children and she did this and she did that. He said, don't you realize that God has called you to be a missionary, but he's given you your mission field there in your home? How can you take those children out to India or wherever it was that she was wanting to go? How can you take those to the other side of the world? Here is your responsibility. And once you fulfill that responsibility, then you may well be free to go and do these things. And that might be touching an issue which you'd say, no, I disagree with you. That's part of the sacrifice of a calling to the mission field. I'm not sure that I find that in Scripture. It might be part of the romantic image of the sacrifice to the mission field. And so easily we have traditions that build up, and we hear those sort of statements, and we don't go back and reflect upon Scripture. Let's be biblically based. Scripture commands that we're to be responsible for our own children first and foremost. Then we exercise our wider ministry. And when we're exercising that wider ministry, whatever it may be, if there's need in the family, it's the family that you must come back to and give the support to. It has to be that way, regardless of how inconvenient it might be. It has to be that way. The example of the father. Have you discovered, men, how frightening it is to discover the example that you are to your children? It's frightening. I've got 3 grown-up daughters, and it's so frightening for them to come back home and say, I never, ever thought it would happen. Courting somebody, and he's just like Dad. We don't intend to be that influence, perhaps. We can't help being it. And it's whether it is a good influence or a bad influence. We will be an influence. Josiah Wedgwood, for those of you who are not from the UK, you might have heard Wedgwood pottery, world-renowned pottery. Well, it's based here in the UK, and the founder was a Josiah Wedgwood, going back a couple of hundred years ago. Wedgwood was a committed Christian. One day he was showing a visitor around the factory, and he had a young apprentice following him. And as he walked around the factory, this visitor was lacking control in his language. Wedgwood was uncomfortable. Eventually took him back to his office. Wedgwood went up to one of the samples there in the office, and he took it. And before his visitor, he smashed it on the ground. He said, what have you done that for? He said, that can be replaced. But the damage you've just done to that young man may never be put right. Can I encourage you to look back and see the damage you've done? And to say to God, I'm sorry. And if you've done damage to your children and they've had an accusation and a grievance and you've said, you have done this and I cannot get over that. Have you talked it through? Maybe there's a legitimate reason for it and maybe they don't understand. But if, honestly, you've been unfair, unjust, have you apologized? You said, I'm sorry, I'm flawed. I try to be what I should be, but I'm flawed. Forgive me, please. I'll try and do better. You try to help me. To try to play act as though we are somehow better than them is just hypocrisy. We're flawed. If you don't recognize that, you haven't begun to understand what the Christian gospel is about. We're examples. And we're to be loved. Now, it's speaking to the fathers, but clearly it has reference to the mothers as well. But the fathers are the head of the home. And their example is so much greater in this particular way. Do you know, one of the problems that we have, men, we're all different, so it's a very sweeping generalization. But we're pretty poor on the emotional side, aren't we? Pretty poor. And yet God our Father is a God of love who cries over us, who strives for us, who actually describes himself in feminine terminology. Can a mother forget the child she sucks? Neither can I forget you, O Israel. Let's not have the macho image that men have got to be men and emotions are for the women. If that's our pattern, quite frankly, we will not relate to our children. And all will be is distant images that somehow inspire awe or threat. As Christian men, we're called to love and have emotion, and that emotion is to our wives and to our children. We've got to develop that if we know that we're weak in it. We've got to recognize that it's not a weakness to be like that. It's an essential part of our humanity. Jesus wept. Was there any lesser man on earth? Here is the model that we have. He weeps. And we're to learn to weep. And we're to learn to love our children and to express it in tenderness and gentleness. And fathers are to teach. This doesn't mean that to ram it down. It means that they're going to give information and understanding bit by bit as the weeks and the months and the years go by. It's got to be measured. It's got to be encouraging. It's got to be in the right way. You can have a fantastic meal with all the calories and it can be presented so lousy that the kid turns away. You've got to think in every way possible, how can I encourage my child to desire Christ? How can I encourage him or her to follow the one I'm trying to follow? It must be a tragedy to be one of the most successful people on earth, having built a personal empire, have achieved incredible respect in your field, perhaps even wealth, and to know that you don't have a good relationship with your wife and with your children. What shall a man give in exchange for his soul? Now that's talking eternally, of course, but what is important in your life? And then Paul comes on to the relationship of masters and slaves. And in chapter 6, verse 4 to 8, he says, slaves, obey your masters with respect and fear, with sincerity of heart, just as you would obey Christ. Obey them not only to win their favor when their eye is on you, but like slaves of Christ doing the will of God from your heart, serve wholeheartedly as if you were serving the Lord, not men. Because you know that the Lord will reward everyone for whatever good he does, whether he is slave or free. So the respect of masters. We're to give those above us respect. Now, we don't have a slave society today. In those days, there were estimated to be 80 million slaves in the Roman Empire. It was fundamental to their society. Paul's not addressing the injustices of slavery. He's addressing the relationships. And this is going to actually evolve and transform lives. But he tells them that they are to respect their masters. And it's not just to be eye service. It's to be done with a commitment for the master's well-being. Now, there were masters who had slaves who were most awful. They would gouge their servants' eyes out. They would put them to death. Paul is not talking in terms of just subjecting yourself to those sort of things. But he's saying, you are in a position where you are to give what is required. Give it fully. I'm not going to dwell upon the problems of slavery. I just want to apply it to today. You're employed. Somebody is paying you a wage. They trust you with your time. You're to use it wisely. You're being paid for it. What is reasonable to ask of you, you're to do. What is unreasonable, if they're cutting right across your commitments to your family, if they're wanting you to work an 18-hour day and have no contact with your children, that should not be so. But you're to give your employer the sort of respect and response that is being echoed here in this passage where Paul directs slaves. And finally, to moving on quickly, what is vital? And masters, treat your slaves in the same way. Do not threaten them, since you know that he who is both their master and yours in heaven, and there is no favoritism with him. Time's gone by, so I'm not going to dwell on each of these points. I just want to underline this fact. There is no favoritism with him. God doesn't give you favors. He gives you grace. It's very different. You never earn that. And God does not look to have favorites. He doesn't. And how we deal with each other, whether it's within our families or whether it's in our work or whatever our relationships are, it should never be on the basis of favoritism. That breeds injustice. It breeds resentment. It breeds division. Have a favorite child in your family and you'll do incalculable damage to the other children. You must deal equally, whether it is in giving them advantages, rewards for their efforts, or whether it's in discipline. There's to be no favorites. Discipline may be exercised in different ways. Different children respond to different types of discipline. But it must be clear to them that they're not being badly treated against another. There is not to be favoritism. God does not show favoritism. What is visual? This is visual. That people don't see your faith, they see your actions. This is visual. If you want to make an impact upon society whilst sharing the gospel is vital, can I tell you that equally as vital is you living this life out? Because this life will either tell people that they're not living as God calls them to, and therefore they'll feel the guilt of it. And that's not the reason why we live this life. Or it will attract them to the God who is the God who is changing us in this way. So it's part of the gospel. It's part of evangelism. And there are many people and they're not confident in articulating their words, but they live lives in their workplace and in their community which people see, and they are so glorifying God. And people come And they actually come to church because they want to know about this God that these people have trusted, because it's so evident in their lives and they're attracted by it and they want to know. You're as much involved in evangelism, even in doing things like that which are just mundane, but you do it in Christ's name. So, the household code tells us what's right, what's promised, what's needed, what's required, and what's visible.